Okay. So today is November 11th, 2010. I am Sheila Contreras, and I am an associate professor in the Department of English. And also, I direct the Chicano Latino Studies program here at Michigan State University. And I am here in the MSU libraries today with Professor Christine Marin from Arizona State University. Professor Marin is an archivist and a teacher of history and women's studies and trans-border Chicana, Chicano, Latina, Latino studies at Arizona State. The last entity I mentioned, trans-border studies, Chicana, Chicana, Latina, Latino studies, is a program now, a department or a
A
college, a
school.
school actually, that Professor Marin helped found at Arizona State. Professor Marin is here with us today to speak about the film, is here at MSU to speak about the film Salt of the Earth, which she just introduced to an audience of students, faculty, staff, community members. And we're going to begin by talking a little bit about that, but then I think we want to segue into talking about women in Chicano political activism more generally. But first, I want to welcome you, Professor Marin, and
Thank you
thank
very
you.
much. It's very nice to be here.
Thank you. Thanks so much for coming up.
Certainly.
In November from Arizona. So, why don't we begin by talking about Salt of the Earth and, in particular, the role of women in the events depicted in that
The
film?
film is very good in showing the life of a typical miner in terms of this community, Bayard, actually, or Hanover in New Mexico. It's a community where there is segregation and racism, or these miners do encounter conflicts away from their work. And the women, of course, are the backbone of the community and the backbone of their homes. But if we look at this period of the 1950s, it's actually a typical picture of women who are in the background. They're not miners. They're not labor organizers. They don't have a role in this particular strike as men in the sense that they're union members. But they do have an important part in this film and in the actual story, because not only are they the wives of the miners and the homemakers of their homes, they are also the women who do understand the importance of supporting the union, the formation of a union, because what the union will do for them, and they see it in a different way than the men do. The men want to make a statement, and their statement is their union. And so they want to earn decent wages, they want better pay, they want the kinds of things that a union will get for them. The women, on the other hand, also want the union, but what the union can do for them through their labor contract with their miners is bring a different kind of equality, gender equality, what we call gender equality. The men are the workers, the men are the doers, the men are the men doing men's work. The women are still women doing women's work. But when the strike occurs and there's an injunction that prevents the miners from maintaining a picket line, the women take over the picket line, and the women become pseudo miners. They maintain the picket line. They don't have to worry about the injunction because they're not breaking the law. They support the strike. They do the work then that the men will end up doing. Yes, they're doing the cooking behind the scenes, but while they are striking, the men have nothing else to do but watch them, because if they participate in the strike, then they break the law. They are defying actually the injunction that's been imposed on them. So the women are marching, they're demonstrating, they're supporting the strike, they're picketing. At home, things have to be taken care of at home, the cooking, taking care of the children, the laundry. So now the men are doing that. They don't like it. They don't like doing the kinds of things that women do. It's women's work. Ha! I don't want to do that, one man says. Another man is shown in the film doing the laundry and putting up the clothes on the clothesline. And his son comes along. And the son sees that the dad is doing his mom's work. But the reality really is that this film isn't so much a film that shows a division of men's work or women's work as much as it really does show a family and a community and a community of Mexican families coming together at the same time, having a consciousness about a labor and a union to bring changes for them in their homes and in their community. And without the women, the strike would not have been successful.
So were there the kinds of results that the women had hoped for in terms of their
own? I don't think the women really knew what they wanted in the beginning. They just wanted what the men wanted. They wanted the strike to be successful because their husbands wanted it. Mm-hmm. But little by little, the women did understand that, hey, we can ask for things too. The men have to pay attention to what we want. One woman says, let's bring in, if we want the union, then should there be a union for plumbing too? Because they can bring hot water into their homes. Mm-hmm. This is where the racist element comes in, because in the homes where the Anglos work, there's hot water. And of course, cold water. And in the homes where the Mexicans live, there's no hot water.
And these were, was this housing provided by the mining
housing
company?
Housing provided by the mining company. Okay. Segregated housing. Anglos live there, Mexicans live there.
Right.
The amenities are there for the Anglo families, like hot water, but they're not there for the Mexican families.
So then...
So the women don't really know exactly what they want as a result of the strike. They just know that things are going to change, and things have to change, because they realize that if it weren't for them, the strike would not be successful. And they want the men to understand that they have a role in this strike too.
Mm-hmm. So the women actually developed a consciousness about the division of labor or gender inequity through participating in
That's
the strike?
Correct. That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay. So, you know, one of the reactions I think that people have to this film when they see it is they're surprised at the role of women. And I think part of it is because we aren't used to seeing active women, and particularly not active Chicanas, represented in that period of history. So for people, I think... You know, there's the unfamiliarity, but I think there's also the assumption that women weren't active at this time or before. Chicanas, for example.
They weren't active like the men were active, but they were active in their auxiliary.
Okay.
Because there is there's a miner's wives auxiliary.
Okay.
That supports the strike, these women.
Right.
They belong to the auxiliary. They go to the union meetings, but they don't have a vote.
Mm-hmm.
They're expected to support the union in different ways, like cooking, bringing food during strikes, but that's the role of the auxiliary. That's their role as women of the auxiliary. It isn't until they attend union meetings where they start to speak up on their behalf and on behalf of the auxiliary and on behalf of their families. It's the family thing. The women are the glue of the family, as noted in this film too. But they're not activists in the same way that you may see the men as activists. They're working. The men, what do? They shut off the machinery to make a statement.
Mm-hmm.
They stop working, or they boycott. Those are strategies that are strike strategies that the men learn and they reinforce and they do.
Mm-hmm.
The women don't do it that way. They support the strike. They know the injunction, like I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And they do, and they man, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word, the picket line. And they know what that means, the picket line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they do the picket line. That's a form of a strike, and that's an action as well.
So I was, as you were talking about the division of labor and things still need to be managed in the household at the same time mm-hmm. that this strike is going on. You talked about, you know, the cooking, the caring for the children, etc. So I know in Chicano literature, especially, and this is coming out of poetry, fiction, as well as in research, that Chicana writers, researchers, as well as Chicanos, have noted a division of labor within the Chicano movement, for example.
Oh, yes.
And so I'm wondering, and that's a place where people have become accustomed to recognizing the presence of women, or accustomed to the idea that women were active in the movement, even if they were relegated to certain spheres, the domestic sphere, for example, you know, cooking the food while the men had the meetings, mm-hmm. or these sorts of things. So I was wondering, And I'd like to hear a little bit about that, because I know you've done research and actually have been, you know, an agent in that regard, that you were, that you participated in the Chicano movement, helping to found the program, the department, now the school at Arizona State. So I'd like to hear about that, but I'm also wondering if you could take it back historically even farther, women's role in Chicano activism, back even farther than the strike in 1953 that we're talking about now. So you had mentioned earlier when we talked, Los Conquistadores,
the first Mexican-American student organization at what we call Arizona State University today. But in 1937, the institution was known as the Arizona State Teachers College at Tempe. The organization was founded by Mexican-American students who wanted their own Mexican-American student organization. Prior to this, there were organizations for students. Mexican-American students were members of the Spanish Club. They were members of clubs that had Spanish names, like Los Hidalgos, for example. But these were Spanish clubs. They were organizations where any student could join, whether you were a Spanish major or not. And it was probably an opportunity to learn a different culture, like Mexico or Latin America. Because you were now a Spanish major, you learned Spanish. But the students recognized what was happening in this period of the 30s during post-depression and even prior to the 1930s in their community of Phoenix, this racism that was so prevalent in the city of Phoenix in terms of school segregation, for example, or poverty was such a rampant thing in the communities in South Phoenix where the Mexicans lived, but there were no social services provided for them like there were for others. And so these students coming from this kind of a background, able to go to college, if you can imagine during the Depression, some of these students able to go to college through sacrifices made by family, parents, grandparents. But they come with a different way of looking at themselves too. They want an education. So that whole myth or stereotype of Mexicans not valuing education is ridiculous. But what you have happening at Arizona State Teachers College is students coming from all over to come to school. They come from the mining towns. They come from the rural area. They mm-hmm. come from the urban centers. And they don't all want to be Spanish majors. Mm-hmm. Some who are see that there's a need for activism to put an end to this racism, and they want their own student organization that will address these issues, not just sit around having somebody make a Mexican dinner mm-hmm. or watch a film about Mexico or somebody bringing pottery and talk about culture that way. They didn't want to live the culture. They wanted to solve issues relative to their own problems. And so they decided to form their own Mexican-American student organization, and they called themselves Mexican-Americans. Mm-hmm. So in 1937, there were groups of students from this kind of a community of students, and they called themselves Los Conquistadores, just in a facetious manner. They called themselves Los Conquis. But to kind of say, we're going to conquer whatever you think we can't conquer, you gringo. Because that was their enemy in a way.
Right.
You know, that whole concept of you can't do this. But so they formed Los Conquistadores, and the women who were also the members were the active members. So what did they do? They had scholarship drives, and they went on speaking tours throughout the state of Arizona in conjunction with other Mexican-American students at other universities like University of Arizona in Tucson mm-hmm. and Arizona State College in Flagstaff, and it was called Arizona State College at the time. While there were more students in the Phoenix area, they were able to link together with these other groups, Spanish groups, Spanish club groups, and raise money and form scholarship drives so that more Mexican-American students who weren't able to come to school would come to school on a scholarship. Mm-hmm. But while they were active, they learned of the activism going on in California through all kinds of Chicano or actually student activities going on in California through these youth groups, student youth groups, specifically Mexican student youth groups.
And this was around 1937 also?
Yes, 1937, 38.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So these are students who are coming to Arizona State Teachers College. The first Mexican-American student, Rosalio Munoz, who was one of the founders of Los Conquistadores, earns for the very first time a Mexican-American from Arizona State Teachers College earning the master's degree in education.
In 1937.
I'm sorry, 1938.
38, okay.
And his thesis is related to bilingual education. He and his cohorts go out and study issues relating to language and bilingualism and culture among Mexican children in the Salt River Valley, Maricopa County, Phoenix area. But he comes away with an education. He becomes a well-known teacher in an area outside of the Salt River Valley. Also, what is very true and what has happened for quite some time in the Phoenix area is that Mexicans were not hired as teachers in the high schools or in any level of education. In elementary schools, there was a scattering of Mexican-American teachers who were hired out of the university or the State Teachers College. But some of these graduate students, or these students who came away with credentials and degrees, diplomas, were not hired. Mm-hmm. They were hired in mining towns. They were hired in rural areas. They were hired in other communities outside of Phoenix. Rosalio Munoz went to St. John's. He had siblings who were as active as he was in Los Conquistadores. He was able to enable them to come to the St. John's area and find them teaching jobs.
And this is St. John's, Arizona.
St. John's, Arizona. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So along the way, we have this consciousness that's being built by students in terms of how to resolve issues relating to racism, school segregation. And these kinds of issues are carried over into the next generation of students. This labor consciousness occurs among them as well. The 40s comes along. The men go off to war. And the women of Los Conquistadores are left behind to carry on the organization of Los Conquis. They do the same things that the men were doing. They have presidents, they have officers, they fund, they do fundraisers, they have scholarship drives, they're very good students. Then the war ends and the men come back and they finish their education too. Then the 50s comes along. Now we have more and more Mexican-American students coming because now we have a different generation coming to school. There's money available, there's a GI Bill. And so you have Mexican-American students who belong to the Spanish Club and more students who are aware of social issues, political issues that they need to get involved in. And the 60s comes along and changes all of that. The Chicano student movement comes to Arizona. The students now don't want to belong anymore to the Spanish Club. They now want to be called the Mexican-American Student Organization, MASO.
Well, they don't want to be called Los Conquistadores They're anymore,
not,
do they?
No. They don't want to be called that either.
Which is sort of in contradiction to the movement ideology,
exactly.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. So with the students who were at what was Arizona Teachers College at the time, in terms of men and women, I'm assuming there were a lot more men than women.
Yes.
So these people who were not getting the teachers' jobs
yes.
in the schools, they were mostly men, predominantly men, some women?
No, men and women
okay.
who were coming away with credentials and degrees
okay.
could not find teaching positions in Phoenix.
So as far back as the 30s, Chicanas
yes.
were being educated.
Yes.
Chicanas were getting
yes.
college degrees.
Yes, in fact,
degrees.
At Tempe Normal School, there was a large group of Mexican women, Mexican-American women, who were students and graduates of the Tempe Normal School in the 20s and the 30s, and they become, of course, members of Los Conquistadores in the 30s. But a very well-known scholar, Dr. Laura Munoz at Texas A&M Corpus, her dissertation, a very good chapter in there about the women of Tempe Normal.
Okay.
All of these Mexican-American women who are students who do very well and move on and become excellent educators in Arizona. They're very, very good teachers, but they just can't find teaching positions in Phoenix.
Right.
So they
right.
go to Clifton Morenci, the mining towns, Globe, Miami. They go to the rural areas, Casa Grande. They go to farming communities away from Phoenix, St. John's, for example, and wherever they happen to find work, Flagstaff. But Phoenix is still very much of a racist, has a mentality about Mexicans teaching their children.
So, you know, I'm thinking about the movement and the sort of work that's come out of women's experiences in the movement. Mm-hmm. Say, for example, Lorna Di Cervantes has this poem, Para un Revolucionario. It's in Emplumada, I think. And she talks about, the speaker in that poem talks about being in the kitchen and trying to hear what the men are saying in the living room, but the pucker of the beans.
Unfortunately, the Chicano student movement had a very typical gender bias.
Well, because what I was wondering, see, in the cases you mentioned before, the men were prevented somehow from action because they had gone away to war, or they were, there was the injunction, and that was when the women stepped in.
Oh, with the strike.
In the Chicano movement, you know, it was different because the men were still there, but the women were also saying, you know, we have a bigger role to play and we have contributions to make. So it sort of a I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what happened.
Well, what happened was that the Chicano student movement was so explosive, and that whole mentality of leadership belonged to the men. So many things were going on at the same time. And the Chicano male loved his ego so much, and he loved white women so much, that he completely ignored the Chicanas, who were also as important to the movement, because they were too busy sleeping with the white women. How many women could we conquer?
The Chicanos were.
The Chicanos did, right. Because it was the women who said, I don't want to have to do that just because you say so. If you want something, there's somebody, there's Susie Q sorority over there. You know, go after her, and they did. So as a result, the women talk about that. The women want to be involved, but the men don't let them be involved. The men don't want them to be involved, but the women maintain a presence. So if I'm going to be the secretary, I'll be the secretary. If I have to type up the minutes, I'll type up the minutes. But in the background, and I'm just talking about Arizona State University, Maso Mecha right now, the women were very active in Maso and in Mecha. They had a presence. They did some of the decision making, but it wasn't that well known that they were making decisions behind the scenes.
Right.
It was the men who came to the forefront to be interviewed by the media. It was the demonstrations being led by the men at the president's office. It was the men who were leading the charge with the signs and so forth. But the women were also making decisions. When we began the Chicano Research Collection, it was called the Chicano Studies Collection at the time, I was meeting with Mecha. They, of course, became MASO, later became Mecha.
Okay, and that's Mexican-American Student Organization, MASO?
MASO,
okay.
At Tempe, M-A-S-O, became Mecha. When I was meeting with the representatives from MASO and then Mecha, the leadership of the men was comprised of men from the mining towns and Phoenix, South Phoenix. There was always a clash in the Chicano movement in terms of leadership, because the urban Chicanos didn't like those of us from mining towns. We weren't too Chicano enough.
What does that mean?
That to them meant they had no idea what it meant growing up and living in a mining town. They had so many stereotypes of those of us from the mining towns, that we drove nice cars, that we were rich, that we lived in these great palatial homes, when in reality...
Miners? They thought miners lived like that?
Yes. Because there were so many of us going to school.
Oh, why was that, do you think?
Very simple. In a mining town, the work is the same for everybody. It's mining. In a mining town, you all live together. When there's a strike, it affects everybody. In a mining town, the pay is consistent. Except when there's a strike, of course, but there's pay. There's a job. There's work. It's not glamorous work. It's hard work. It's difficult work, but there's work. You're not moving from place to place. It isn't a migrant stream in a mining town. You have a support system. You have family. You have neighbors. You have the union. You see? So you come away with this labor consciousness of unity and working together.
That and includes with Anglos?
Yes.
Okay.
But we also come away from the mining town not being afraid of Anglos, because we're competitive. We're aggressive. We do better than you do in school. We're better athletes than you are. Plus, the men are more handsome than you are. So when we come away from the mining towns, we have this attitude already. We're not afraid of little gringuito. We're going to speak English just as good as you are. Mm-hmm. So here we come away competing with the Chicanos from Phoenix. They don't like us because we speak English. Mm-hmm. We have money. We drive cars. We have a better home, mm-hmm. which is not true, of course. It's all very stereotyped vision. Mm-hmm. When they want to show us the barrio and they take us to the barrio, hell, man, they live in better houses than we lived in. This is your house that you say you live in poverty in the barrio?
The mining kids were saying this.
The kids from South Phoenix, were saying that to us, the mining kids. We're going to take you to the barrio so you know exactly how we live. We live in poverty.
So but we to go, the mining kids, it didn't look like poverty.
No.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
They live in nice houses. They have paved streets. I mean, it's quite a contrast. You're griping and complaining because you live in the barrio? Mm. Man, that's a nice house you live in. Why don't you come up to the mining town and see how we live?
So how did these sorts of tensions play out within MECHA and the history of MECHA or other student organizations at Arizona State?
Because the MECHA leadership was made up of men and women from mining towns and from South Phoenix or from the city, they were able to get along because the larger issue was politics.
Okay.
So forget this little fighting going on about the men and the women and about the Anglo women taking away the men and the men wanting the white women more than Chicanas, all of that inner fighting going on. It was part of the, you know, growing up. Mm-hmm. But the big picture was the political scene. Now we have Chicano students active in South Phoenix community in campaigns, city council, the Senate, you know, these kinds of campaigns that are going on at the same time during the civil rights era. The stereotype of a civil rights movement isn't about African Americans. It's really about Chicanos too. Mm-hmm. During the Chicano movement, it was a civil rights movement.
Okay.
It was a civil rights movement going back to the 30s when Los Conquistadores were fighting for the same thing, equality.
Right, it's all connected.
It's all connected.
Most people, I think one of our presumptions in Chicano studies is that the Chicano movement was the beginning of Mexican-American political activism.
No.
But what you're saying is that
it goes really back in Arizona to the 20s with the Latin American Club, forming a link with the Alianza Hispanoamericana, founded in Tucson in the 1890s. Mm-hmm. The Alianza forms lodges or logias and chapters throughout the state, throughout the United States. They become a very important, powerful political tool, the Alianza Hispanoamericana. The women are involved in LULAC. LULAC comes into the picture, links with the Alianza just as easily, just as well. So it carries over not only away from the institutional education, but into the communities as well.
So would you say that this...
So the civil rights movement, if you talk about civil rights in terms of Mexicanos or Chicanos or Mexican-Americans, really has its birth in the 1890s, and it carries through the different generations of movement activism.
So would you say that this particular formation with the students from the mining towns and the urban students, would you say that that distinguished the development of Chicano student activism, Chicano and Chicana student activism
in
Arizona?
At Arizona? Yes.
Did that make for something different
than
you'd seen in a place like California or Texas?
It made it different, and what made it different was unionism, labor, mining towns. It was very different. Arizona, that's why Arizona's different.
Okay. Okay.
Although you do have divisions in other states, yes. For example, California, just as an example, in terms of farm workers or migrant workers or agricultural laborers, the North and the South states, the North section and the South section of California, the Chicano students hated each other. The ones from the North and the Chicano movement didn't like the ones in Southern California. The Southern California Chicano activists were activists. They were Chicano movement activists. Those of you guys up there in the North, you didn't even know what activism was. But they didn't have any idea what it was like for these migrant workers living in the Northern California and the suffering that they went through, which isn't to say that that didn't happen in the agricultural field in Southern California either. What I'm trying to say is that they just didn't know each other. They didn't learn each other about each other's own little backyard, if you want to call it that. Just like what happened in at Arizona State. They didn't know anything about mining towns. We came from a mining town to go to school. We didn't know anything about barrio. What are you talking about, barrio? You mean it like ghetto? Mm-hmm. Because that was a popular term. Mm-hmm. Barrio? Well, doesn't that just mean neighborhood? Mm-hmm. No, barrio. Oh, well, what does it look like? Oh, man, you live better than we do. We don't, you know, look at that.
It's interesting because...
Well, look at the kind of car you're driving to school.
At the same time that there's this sort of like, you know, it's impoverished and the barrio is someplace that, you know, is in desperate need of change, et cetera. There's also a pride in being from the barrio.
Yes,
you know?
But there's also money available for you to go to school from the barrio.
And not from the mining towns?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is let's not forget the students who could not afford to go to school.
Right. So there were some students that weren't even represented.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Don't forget those who couldn't afford to go to school,
mm-hmm.
who couldn't get financial aid,
mm-hmm.
or it was too far away to go to school.
Mm-hmm. See? Well, it's interesting because once you become a student and once you have that privilege, then you're not of that class
That's
anymore
right.
of the people who
That's
are
right.
utterly disenfranchised.
You may say you're fighting for them.
Right.
But
you're not one of them
you're
anymore.
You're not one of them anymore.
Right. Yeah, that's the whole issue of can the subaltern speak? But that's another topic.
Okay.
So what I did want to hear more about, too, though, is women's leadership, like in the Arizona State, Chicano, in Mecha, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how has that developed over the years that you've been there? I know you're an advisor. Aren't you the Mecha
I was advisor? I was a Mecha advisor. I was a student of the Mecha organization as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was a Mechista. Granted, I wasn't a full-time member because I was working at the same time going to school.
Right.
Full-time, but, you know, I went to the Mecha meetings. I was a Mecha advisor and a Mecha consultant, so, yeah. So we had Mecha women as Mecha presidents.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, wow. That was unheard of at other places. Amaya Candelaria, the first Mexican-American woman to be president of Mecha. Then we have several women.
When was that?
That occurred in the 70s.
Okay, okay.
74. 73.
That seems early to me for that to happen.
Yeah. Well, Arizona was, you know, the women were saying, hey, we're here too.
Right. It sounds like they were actually maybe, I don't know, specifically at ASU or within Arizona more generally, that they were able to maybe break into some of those positions earlier than they might have done other places.
Perhaps. But then there was a lot of political dynamics going on in Phoenix. And the Salt River Valley as well in terms of the political scene.
Mm-hmm.
Now we had Mexican-American political activists becoming elected officials.
Mm-hmm.
Alfredo Gutierrez comes in 72 as the leader of the Senate with his campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had a campaign to support the Raúl Castro, who becomes the governor.
Mm-hmm.
For the very first time, Mexican-American governor,
mm-hmm.
even though he was born in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a lot of activism on campus, but you had more activism away from campus in the political scene.
Right.
City council was important to get city council representation for
right.
South Phoenix. It was important to get involved politically at the state level to get senators involved,
to have representation. Would you say that within the Chicano movement that there was, in your experience, a real recognition of the importance of such positions in sort of the traditional political sphere? I mean, or was there within, you know, the sort of radical consciousness of the movimiento, was there a disdain for that kind of political activity?
No,
you know what I'm saying?
What was happening?
Or was it recognized as part of the same struggle?
Same struggle.
Or as something conventional?
Same struggle.
Same
struggle. But what was happening in Arizona State, like everywhere else, in terms of student movement, were the student movements against the war.
Mm-hmm.
Student movement, civil rights, for example, another frame of thought. But the hippies,
mm-hmm.
you know, that type of student movement, as mm-hmm. the yuppies, that type mm-hmm. of student movement, they were there. All of them were there. All of these groups were there. But it was the Chicano students and Mecha who really radicalized the thinking of a lot of these Chicano students to want to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't even from South Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have those problems in the mining towns. We had the union who solved those problems with us and for us. We had our dads who were union members and involved in their union
mm-hmm.
because it was the union that brought equality in the mining towns,
mm-hmm.
equal pay. My dad went through a lot of struggles with, and a lot of men like him, mm-hmm. Mexican work, Anglo work, Mexican pay, Anglo pay, mm-hmm. separate pay lines, mm-hmm. separate shower facilities.
Right.
The union comes along and takes care of and gets rid of all of that, not just for the Mexicano miner, but for all the miners who belong to the union. Mm-hmm. And you see that. You don't recognize it or understand it when you're little, but after a while, little by little, you see it, you understand it, and you have it when you go away and you grow up and you go to school, and you see all of it now in different perspective. This thing called organization.
Right.
This thing called organizing for a cause, organizing, bringing people together who are different, but bringing them together once you understand it. And who better to verbalize that and show it is Cesar Chavez. Mm-hmm. He shows these students what to do and how to do it. Cesar Chavez never, ever said he was a Chicano movement leader. He was always a labor organizer.
Organizer, that's right. Well, so, you know, the other thing that interests me about what you're saying in terms of the union working on behalf of all the miners is, I think also within the history of union organizing in the U.S., there is the very real thread of racism throughout
yes.
union organizing. So, for example, in this part of the country,
in Arizona, Michigan, you had the Mexican Miners Union.
Right.
In Clifton, Morenci, in Miami, for example.
Well,
but then they become more...
More integrated?
Yes, more
because,
egalitarian.
Uh-huh. You know, here in this part of the country, in Michigan, with the auto industry,
and
Michigan's a union state. But I remember watching a video, finally got the news about black Detroit and black auto workers and black industrial workers in Detroit, and they're carrying signs and chanting, UAW means you ain't white. UAW means you ain't white. And wow. So, but what you're telling me about the unionizing or union activity or union membership in Arizona sounds very different than this story.
It brought together all the workers to belong to a union that would work on their behalf, and not only Anglo workers, Mexican American workers, mm-hmm. African American mm-hmm. workers in the mining towns, mm-hmm. especially in Globe and Miami.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, Italians, mm-hmm. yeah.
So the central identity was as a worker, not as
That's
a
right.
Mexican worker
exactly.
or an Anglo worker.
That's right.
You know, the other thing I'm thinking about, too, is here it is, November 11th, 2010. And I think by all accounts, for those of us in higher ed who believe in ethnic studies, in Chicano-Latino studies, that we recognize there's something really serious going on in Arizona right now. Going in the sphere of higher ed as well as the level of public education, with the attempts to dismantle ethnic studies curriculum first at the high school level, and then combine with that the attack on immigrants that's also going on in Arizona. So I'm wondering, what kind of student activism do you see around these issues in Arizona, and what's the connection to what came before? And as you're observing this, you know, what have been the roles of women? How central have women been?
The women have been very active along with the men mm-hmm. in defying any attempts to quash educational opportunities for all students.
Mm-hmm.
The DREAM Act, for example, is a good one. Ethnic studies, raza studies, or whatever you want to call it today, but Chicano studies for that matter. The mentality of what's happening politically in Arizona today is anti-immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
Anti-illegal,
mm-hmm.
anti-Mexican,
mm-hmm.
anti-anything that looks like Mexican. Day laborer, for example, there's an attempt to get rid of all of that, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's really Mexicanos are a target, have become the target, and have always been a target along the border.
Mm-hmm.
The borders have sometimes been open. Sometimes there's restrictions, sometimes there are harsh restrictions, but the border is porous. People come and go all the time, no matter how high you have the fence or how wide you have it. People are going to find a way to come and cross that border or die in the desert crossing the border. But the mentality that is being expressed today by people who have not only, they're not new, they're just called different things now, Tea Party. But they've always been anti-Mexican. This conservative right-wing John Birch, Anglo-American, white, whatever you want to call it, mentality. That anything that is different than their claim of what an American should be is not an American. You're brown. You're not white.
Mm-hmm.
You speak
mm-hmm.
Spanish. You don't speak English. But we love your Mexican food. and we'll go to the Mexican restaurant and eat it. Mm-hmm. But you're illegal. Mm-hmm. Don't you get it? You're breaking the law. How simple can it be? Don't you get it? You're breaking the law. You're illegal. Go back. You become an American through the ways that are in the process that's there. To become a citizen, do that. But don't come and break the law and do it. Mm-hmm. But yet, at the same time, there's always that conflict between those who oppose immigration and illegal immigrants and Mexican workers are in contrast to those who welcome workers because it's the workers who are cheap laborers. See?
Yeah, exactly.
You always have that in all the industries. They want
right.
the workers because they're cheap.
Right.
And they'll hire them. They'll break the law, although they say they don't. They'll hire knowingly, although they say they don't know that this guy's illegal. They'll hire him because he's cheap. So on the one hand, you have, it's really an attempt to keep cheap labor.
And to not be responsible for the reproduction of that labor or the care of terms of insurance.
And in education now, you see many, many students who are international students or who are students from other countries coming to a university like Arizona State University with their proper papers who are also questioned. Mm-hmm. But there are others who say, well, this is an American institution and it's for Americans and you're not an American and why should taxpayers pay for your education?
Mm-hmm.
Even though there's a scholarship put aside, even though there's federal money put aside, even though there's money set aside by the president put aside for that and all kinds of things that enable people to come to school, even though that's all legal.
Right.
It's still in some mind of others, my money. And how can you tell me how to spend my money? Mm-hmm. I don't want to spend it on you. You're illegal.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's really crazy what's going on in Arizona and Phoenix. You see it mainly in the urban mm-hmm. center, Phoenix and Tucson. You don't see that kind of mentality outright in outside of the urban center. In the rural areas or the mining towns, you don't see that.
Right.
You don't hear that.
Right. It sounds like there are lots of struggles in Arizona right now.
Mm-hmm.
We should all be paying attention. Yes. Well, I want to thank you, Professor Marin.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to come and speak with you. It's been a very enlightening opportunity for me as well.
And we're so happy you were able to make the trip up here to Michigan State University here on November 11th, 2010. And I guess that's a wrap.